Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger Podcast. There Is a Season is a podcast devoted to reevaluating the work, music, and politics of the late American folk musician Pete Seeger. On this show, we work towards rediscovering and getting more in touch with Pete Seeger's contributions to better understand how we can more fully apply them now and in the future. Join us today as we get into the founding of the Weavers, their rise to popular prominence, and the decline of their success in the early days of the Blacklist. After Peekskill, Pete Seeger was keeping busy. He already had a few other logs going in the fire before the hectic and frightening end to that summer. During the remainder of 1949, outside of working on the new home in Beacon and visiting friends and acquaintances in the hospital who had been injured at Peekskill, Pete had been rehearsing with a new musical quartet he and Lee Hayes had been putting together called The Weavers. The other members of The Weavers were 1. Fred Hellerman, a 22-year-old guitar player who had recently graduated from Brooklyn College. As a teenager, Hellerman had hung around the Almanac House during Hootenannies and had been an active member of People's Songs. Their other member was Ronnie Gilbert. Ronnie also knew Pete and Lee going back to the early 1940s when she was in high school, as she hung around with the Almanacs and attended many of their Hootenannies in Greenwich Village before the war as well. Fred and Ronnie first met one another when they both attended and were counselors at a Jewish summer camp in New Jersey. Thus, this new association as a quartet was, in many respects, a long time coming. The Weavers had been playing as a group since the end of the Wallace campaign a year prior. They had performed at Hootenannies during the final months of People's Songs, and in January of 49 had played on Oscar Brand's Folk Song Festival radio program on WNYC. But by the fall of 1949, Pete and Lee were working on getting the group together in a more formal way, and they all began rehearsing regularly. Given the collapse of People's Songs and fear injected into progressive organizations because of Peekskill, many in New York City did not want to gather in public places where music was involved, and therefore the group wasn't receiving any invitations to sing for benefits. Some of the group's material, like If I Had a Hammer, was seen as too radical, and many believed it was advocating Soviet politics. As we know, this song would go on to become a pop hit over a decade later, with a variety of rock and roll artists, and it's perplexing to find that something like If I Had a Hammer, with such a tight rhythmic feel, wouldn't be attractive to listeners. However, the reactionary anti-communist post-war political imagination effectively prevented the Weavers from really doing anything with this type of music. The quartet did have a few gigs in their political wheelhouse around this time, such as performing in January of 1950 as part of a tribute concert with Woody Guthrie, Gene Ritchie, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, and others for Leadbelly, who had died recently, and later in March worked alongside Howard Fast and Paul Robeson in doing a benefit concert to support victims of the Peekskill riots in their lawsuit against the Westchester County Police Department. But these types of jobs were in the minority. Ultimately, the four musicians found that the only way they could make a living was through commercial work. Pete discovered that either other folk music contemporaries were getting gigs over him, and or that clubs, unions, and campaigns would let him sing, but not Lee, Fred, or Ronnie. When Seeger started observing this going on, he let down his guard a bit and warmed up to the idea of doing more commercial gigs. After all, he and the others needed to make a living somehow. In Pete's words, because of all the restrictions on getting work, quote, "I decided to stop congratulating myself on not going commercial," unquote. Let's hear Fred Hellerman explain the motivation the group had to try and find a commercial gig in order to continue playing music together.
We decided, well, wait a second. Let's see if we could maybe get a job somewhere, at some nightclub or something, so that we can make enough money so that we could live and stay together so that we can continue to sing down in Pete's basement on Wednesday afternoons.
The group was about to break up due to their lack of jobs, but at the last minute they landed their first major gig at the Village Vanguard in Greenwich Village. Max Gordon, the owner of the club, initially did what others were doing to Pete, only offering him the gig. But Pete suggested to Gordon that he let the others play as well, with all four of them splitting Seeger's fee. Gordon miraculously agreed to this, and the Weavers got a job singing for $200 a week, with free hamburgers thrown in. Ironically, before long, Gordon discovered how frequently Pete was making hamburgers in the back between sets, not to mention they were bigger than your normal garden variety burgers. Because of this, Gordon changed the contract. He told Seeger they'd get a raise to $250 a week, but no more free burgers. As a side note, if you've been wondering where the group's name came from, the suggestion came mainly from Fred Hellerman. Hellerman had read the 19th century play, The Weavers, by Gerhard Hauptmann, which is about an uprising of workers in Silesia, a region and province that existed within the Prussian Empire. Hellerman liked the idea of different things being woven and threaded together into a unified fabric, which was very much the social and musical philosophy of the group, taking older melodies and styles and meshing them together and making something accessible and relatable for listeners. As such, this became their name. The Weavers ended up opening during Holiday Week in December 1949 at the Vanguard. While their friends showed up during the first week or two, the crowds eventually got somewhat sparse, with the quartet sometimes only drawing a dozen or less people per night. But Max Gordon liked the music and kept them on. The Weavers prided themselves as being one of the few groups that got to rehearse on stage. With such a small audience, the stakes were low, and the group had much time every night to work out their arrangements and harmonies. As it turned out, the Weavers ended up staying at the Vanguard for 6 months, and they slowly developed more of an audience. Alan Lomax brought the poet Carl Sandburg to see the group at one point, who thought very highly of them. It was also during this period that the Weavers met the man that would become their manager. Harold Leventhal was the son of Eastern European Orthodox Jews and had grown up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He had been in the young Communist League like Seeger had in the 30s, and had also been involved in other left-wing causes. By the time he was 20 years old, he had acquired initial experience in the music business working for Irving Berlin and Benny Goodman, and had served in the Signal Corps in World War II, and had also worked on the Wallace campaign in 1948. Given Leventhal's political background, he was in many respects the right person to manage the Weavers. The night the group met Harold at the Vanguard, Pete asked him if he wanted to be their manager, and Leventhal immediately accepted. Leventhal would go on to be an important person in the Weavers' lives long after the period of the Blacklist, but he was of course very instrumental in their success in the early 50s. Eventually, word got around that the Weavers were an act that people should go and see. The New York World Telegram reviewed them in a January 11th article, giving the group positive reviews. The descriptions of the different members of the group are a little stereotypical and exoticizing. For example, likening Seeger to a lanky, banjo-strumming farm boy, and Hayes was a, quote, rotund ex-preacher from Arkansas, unquote. While this is a bit distracting, it's likely a product of not knowing exactly how to characterize the music. Either way, the Weavers are described as exciting, especially given the fact that they were very improvisational and that the audience doesn't know exactly which song they were going to do next. A January 27th article from the Daily Compass also gave the musicians a warm reception, saying that the group was extraordinarily talented at breaking the ice with their first song, and the crowd would visibly become invested in the show. During this period of January to June 1950, the Weavers' 40-minute or so performance at the Vanguard would look something like this. They'd open up with the Saints Go Marching In, and follow it with something like Leadbelly's Midnight Special. Lee might tell jokes between songs, then Ronnie might sing a solo number, backed up by Fred playing the bass notes on the guitar, and with Pete providing some accompaniment on the recorder. Here's a couple examples of Ronnie's solo numbers from the Weavers' records, I Know Where I'm Going, and Every Night When the Sun Goes Down, respectively. These tunes are a good illustration of Ronnie's powerful vocal abilities.
I know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who I love, and my dear knows who I'll marry. Well, I'd have stockings of silk and shoes of bright green leather, combs to buckle my hair, and a ring for every night when the sun goes down. Every night when the sun goes down. Every night when the sun goes down, I hang down my head and mournful cry.
These examples are from the studio recordings, as it appears as if there's no live audio recordings of the Weavers at the Village Vanguard in 1950, not that we could have necessarily expected that there would be. Despite this, perhaps one of the best representations of the Weavers' live shows is their record, The Weavers on Tour. The songs on this record include folk song classics spiced up with a pop feel, notably Clementine, Boll Weevil, and Michael Row the Boat Ashore.
Excavating for a mine, dwelt a miner, 49er, and his daughter, Clementine. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling, Clementine. You are lost and gone forever, dreadful sorry, Clementine.
Light she was and like a fairy, and her shoes were number 9.
Honey, get up and stand on your 2 big feet. Take a look over yonder in Arkansas at all the cotton we've got to eat. We'll have a home.
We'll have a home.
We'll have a home.
We'll have a home.
What we can hear in these arrangements is how each member of the group complements each other. Ronnie's voice along with the male voices blend very well, especially Lee's bass singing. Fred's rhythm guitar playing is very tight, playing your regular folk chords, but definitely using bar chords to chop out the appropriate beats. What we can take away from all this is that all members of the group bring out its sound. And it's important not to label Seeger as the most important member of the Weavers, which the press sometimes did at this time, and what some people still continue to do. This is not to put down Seeger at all. Of course, as we can hear, along with the group's very intentional harmonic vocal arrangements, Seeger would incorporate his now very well-honed banjo skills, also doing intros to the songs that very subtly touched on a piece of social commentary. One such example of this, although not on that live record, was the audience favorite Wimaway, coming from a Zulu song from South Africa, which Pete heard off of a record Alan Lomax gave him of South African musicians. Wimaway, typically credited to South African Solomon Linda, has a somewhat complicated history and really deserves an entire episode devoted to analyzing it. In short, though, Lomax wanted some of these songs to have a wider audience, so Pete adapted the song from the record as best he could understand one particular word. With melodies like this, Pete would be successful in getting folks to sing along. As the Daily Compass article says about the Weavers' stage presence developed during their show, quote, "By this time, the patrons have shed their hideaway complex. Minstrelsy has brought them together, and as one, they join in on the choruses," unquote. The article also indicates that 7 encores a night was normal. Weavers would typically end their set at the Vanguard with Leadbelly's famous tune, Goodnight Irene. But as opposed to singing the original Leadbelly lyrics, the quartet chose to drop the more crude lyrics of I'll Get You in My Dreams to I'll See You in My Dreams, as well as losing a verse referencing morphine, something perhaps a bit more accessible and PG for the audience. In examining the Weavers' entire repertoire, their choice of songs and style of arrangements, while being pop, were all still very much intentionally chosen, as Pete, Lee, Ronnie, and Fred were clearly trying to convey social commentary through their work. Goodnight Irene, while a love song, was undoubtedly a component of this. David Dunaway suggests that singing a song by a black man who was formerly incarcerated was a statement in itself. In a sense, this is true, as no other performers at this time were attempting anything quite like this, and it is interesting to observe that a song like Irene would cut through as something commercial. However, this was all probably so because audiences just didn't really think about it very much. At the same time, how many songs that come out of the American carceral experience have made it as top hits? There are thousands of songs written in prisons across the United States in contemporary times, and many more going back to the postbellum period. But much of the public has certainly never heard the majority of these. More on that question of authenticity shortly. In regard to their six-month stint at the Vanguard, not only did they meet their manager through this exposure, but the Weavers were also introduced to a Decca Records producer and arranger named Gordon Jenkins. Seeger and the others were only minorly aware of Jenkins' work, as he had existed more in the jazz realm, and thus they weren't really familiar with him. Either way, the group discovered that Jenkins was well-connected and had previously recorded Louis Armstrong and Frank Sinatra. Jenkins stated to the quartet that they were the exact type of group that the label was looking for, and that they should come by Decca's offices for a meeting. Seeger still wasn't enthused about the commerciality of things and struggled to take the offer seriously. However, Pete, Lee, Ronnie, and Fred did take up Jenkins on this invitation. On this interaction, Seeger later explained that, as he expected, the Weavers were not initially appreciated by the Decca executives. When they arrived for the meeting, they saw Dave Capp, the head of Decca, who apparently took one look at them and was turned off. Capp was likely familiar with Seeger as having been a lead member of the Almanac Singers 8 years prior and was fully aware that Seeger and the others were lefties. But Jenkins told the group not to worry and that he would schedule them for a recording session anyways, which he did. So, on May 4th, 1950, a day after Seeger's 31st birthday, the Seegers went into Decca Studios to record two songs, Tzana Tzana Tzana, an Israeli soldier song about fighting men coming home from war, and Leadbelly's tune Goodnight Irene. By June, the Weavers' popularity exploded. Tzana peaked at number 2 on the Billboard charts and stayed there for 13 weeks. Soon after, singers Vic Damone and Ralph Flanagan recorded their own versions of the tune. Then in July, disc jockeys got curious about the B-side of the 45 and started playing Irene, which reached number 1. Within the month, Frank Sinatra had recorded his own version of the song, reaching number 5. In later years, Pete would emphasize that he was basically flabbergasted that a waltz could be a hit song, but evidently, it was possible. Truthfully, though, whether a song is a hit is a combination of listener interest and commercial promotion, and this is exactly what went into Irene's popularity. Publisher Howie Richmond mailed copies of Irene to 1,500 DJs, many of which were his own personal contacts from having previously worked with Frank Sinatra in Dinah Shore. This was likely a major force in the quantity of airplay the song got. In addition to the 500,000 records sold, Richmond also sold 250,000 copies of the song's sheet music. In short, you couldn't go anywhere in the U.S. in the bottom half of 1950 without hearing Goodnight Irene somewhere, sometime. Let's hear Pete explain what he thought of the Weavers' popularity.
It was kind of a fluke that we reached a large number of people at all. Really, I don't think any of us ever expected to be selling a couple million records. But once we did, we found all sorts of possibilities there, and it was very exhilarating to reach a large number of people.
As the Weavers' popularity took off with listeners in the early summer of 1950, so too did their recognition in trade publications. Downbeat reviewed the group's music, stating that Decca would have trouble placing them in terms of genre. After all, they were neither country nor pop nor jazz, certainly, even with all of Gordon Jenkins' orchestral arrangements, but somewhere in between, a musical territory that hadn't really existed yet. Additionally, by the end of June, Variety mentioned the Weavers 5 times in the same issue.
Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams.
Sometimes I live in the country. Sometimes I live in town. Sometimes I take a great notion to jump into the river and drown.
What Pete is potentially referring to in the previous clip by these quote-unquote possibilities is that the group was able to reach people in a way a pop group hadn't really reached people before. As such, in recognition of the Weavers' initial success, one question with which we are faced is why a folk song quartet was so attractive to Decca and mass audiences during this period. The typical answer is their simplicity. The group took more complicated musical and lyrical ideas and digested them for easier consumption. This, of course, is potentially what makes many musical groups successful in their own time. The music of Leadbelly, Woody Guthrie, Appalachia, coal mining songs, union songs, and blues numbers that Pete had consumed for the last 15 years was, by itself, raw and challenging to interpret for many listeners. The Weavers were able to see the formula behind these styles and boil them down. When they wanted to record Guthrie's song So Long It's Been Good to Know Ya, Decca informed the group that lyrics about the Dust Bowl were too dated, and so the group wrote new words. In doing the song in the lyrically watered-down way Decca wanted, the politics very likely did not come through for listeners. Guthrie was elated that his song would make it through as a hit, though, also running to Moe Ash at Folkways to make sure it was copyrighted, which it had been. But the Weavers were not first to simplify folk music, as they had learned from the masters already. As Pete explains in his autobiography, The Incomplete Folk Singer, it was people like Leadbelly and Guthrie that were experts at combining the old with the new. But ironically, despite the popularity of this early 50s approach to doing folk music, within the next 10 to 15 years, many of the post-war folk singers would actually somewhat reject the Weavers because of this question of cultural authenticity. Irwin Silber started this conversation in Sing Out magazine when he attacked Seeger and the others for not having the right to sing black folk songs or blues tunes. While Silber raises a critical question, the tone of his writing can also be seen as somewhat self-righteous, and this was Seeger's response, later stating that Silber didn't really understand music. This critique was also made in a Time article in August, reviewing Goodnight Irene. The review disappointingly labels Leadbelly as the, quote, murderous old minstrel, unquote, but goes on to attack the Weavers' version, saying it had been, quote, prettied up and cut in half, unquote. These are generally classic critiques. However, there were legal issues with Zana as well, as the origin of the song is coming from Israel was found in a songbook by some people affiliated with people's artists, and Seeger soon picked it up. A legal conflict ensued between an Israeli, Isaac Ermiran, who claimed he composed the song's third part. A legal technicality, however, prevented anyone from directly copying the version done by the Weavers. This sort of thing is indeed an issue with appropriation, ownership, and royalties that becomes very difficult to control. Although, the question of Zana's musical or cultural authenticity seems to be less discussed than how it is with Irene. Pete would go on to suggest for most of his life that if you want to get audiences to appreciate something that has come before at all, or is from a tradition other than your own, you have to update it and recast it somehow, or the sharing process can't even begin to work. As a side note, Lead Belly had died in December of 1949 from ALS. Eventually, the royalties from the success of the song did save Hughie's widow, Martha, from complete abject poverty. On the flip side, Gordon Jenkins put some heavy violin and classical orchestration onto Goodnight Irene, which of course is not how Lead Belly played the tune. What we ought to remember is when it comes to sharing music that isn't originally your own creation, what makes the difference is the question of one's intentionality. One place where we'd see this more fully, put into context, is Elijah Wald's 2015 book, Going Electric, which is a very critical evaluation of the inception of the Newport Folk Festival, and the deeper significance behind how people have interpreted and misinterpreted Bob Dylan's performance with the Butterfield Blues Band at the Newport Festival in 1965. Wald emphasizes the musical approach that Dylan, Dave Van Ronk, Fred Neil, and others of their ilk attempted to utilize in Greenwich Village in the early 60s, where they looked to examples like Hetty West, John Lee Hooker, and the New Lost City Ramblers and Roscoe Holcomb for inspiration. In doing so, the folk songwriters of that time in the village largely rejected the Weavers because they saw the Weavers as lacking the rootsy depth that would more effectively inform their songwriting, what Wald calls the neo-ethnic approach. Dylan and his contemporaries who were doing this neo-ethnic practice were fully aware that the Weavers had smoothed things over, and knew it wasn't the real thing. Ironically, though, Seeger spent more time uncovering the real thing in person at Southern festivals, prisons, juke joints, front porches, and in cotton fields than Dylan, Van Ronk, or Neil ever did. But it was also perhaps this reason and lack of experience that these songwriters sought out something more raw for themselves.
But I'll sing it again of the people I've met and the places I've been. Some of the troubles that bothered my mind and a lot of good people that I've left behind. Singing
so long, it's been good to know ya. So long, it's been good to know ya. So long, it's been good to know ya. What a long time since I've been home, and I gotta be drifting along.
The sweethearts they said.
Either way, whether the audiences saw it or not, the Weavers made a contribution. Seeger perhaps didn't necessarily realize this right away himself, as he never actually thought of himself as a pop act, even though he and his bandmates definitely were. Once in Decca's offices, Pete was having a conversation with some of the executives and was speaking about one of the label's other artists as being, quote, one of those Decca stars, unquote. The Decca execs looked at Seeger peculiarly and said, don't you realize you're one of those Decca stars? Despite this, Seeger didn't really feel as if he had actually become a success. These conventional accolades were not anywhere near as inspiring to Pete as having played at Madison Square Garden for the thousands of striking transit workers in 1941. As one might expect, Seeger was deeply questioning whether he was really changing anything. On the one hand, he had his hammer, but felt ineffective with it. That is, it wasn't really the hammer he was looking for. Pete Cameron, one of Decca's execs, warned Pete about performing any political material with the group. If the group could just focus on the pop-style folk music that they were doing right now, then in a few years they'd be able to do anything they wanted. Seeger was reluctant, but went along with this, at least for a while. Pete, of course, felt censored, but he would have to be comfortable subtly inserting social commentary into the Weavers' performances, which they were able to do to some extent with some of the old Spanish Civil War songs, songs like Wimaway, and Wasn't That a Time. Eventually, as we will learn, the Weavers would be canceled from being able to do even this.
Brave men who fought at Gettysburg now lie in soldiers' graves, but there they stand, the rebel tide and there. This land was saved.
Wasn't that a time to try? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
Now, with the success of Goodnight Irene and Xena, the Weavers began touring the country. They played Ciro's in Hollywood, the Shamrock in Houston, and the Casinos in Reno. Back in New York City, they played the Strand Theater on Broadway and the famous Manhattan venue, the Blue Angel. Playing at these places, they were all making over $2,000 a week. While the other members of the group enjoyed the traveling, hotels, room service, and clubs where they played, these things did not amuse Pete very much. Once when being plied with alcohol, Pete was so frustrated about having to refuse multiple times that he stood up and slammed down his banjo on a table, breaking it in two. Pete preferred spending his downtime doing creative art projects in his hotel room and visiting music stores in the different cities they were all playing in, at one point even buying a trumpet and trying to learn to play, much to the chagrin of hotel management. In 1951, Toshi went on tour with the group to function as their road manager and assist with bookings, a big help to everyone. Up to this point, of course, Toshi had played an essential role in supporting all of Pete's political and musical endeavors. While the walls and roof had gone up on their new home in Beacon during the summer of 1950, she had been living in a house that was not yet fully complete and raising the kids with Pete gone. When Pete and Toshi returned from this tour in 51, however, the children did not recognize them. Pete's son Danny was essentially reintroduced to his dad by Toshi's father, Takashi. Toshi never quite forgave Pete for this. When he was touring, Pete felt quite guilty about being away from his family, and the moments he was back between trips were awkward, as he knew he would soon be leaving his children again.
Pleaded like a natural man, and then, oh Lord, I gave him my hand.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine. Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.
Despite Pete's existential qualms and his uncertainty about the function and application of the music, he was getting back on his feet financially, at least. But not all parties were happy about the Weavers' success. While much of their audience didn't care one bit about the group's history as political musicians, some people did. Those who were frustrated by their popularity were the anti-communist publication Counterattack and the FBI. As was discussed in a previous episode, Counterattack, the newsletter on facts of communism, was a publishing house founded in 1947 and released a weekly newsletter that promoted anti-communism and sought to identify people, organizations, institutions, and other publications as being so-called communist in nature. As author Nancy Bernhardt explains, the publication was originally funded by a man named Alfred Kohlberg, an importer of Chinese textiles, who paid three former FBI officials to found the company American Business Consultants. American Business Consultants was the firm that put out Counterattack and functioned as its fundraising mechanism. Editorial and research staff were hired, and subscriptions were solicited from staff canvassing New York City office buildings. Radio stations were also solicited and began referencing and quoting the publication on a regular basis. Before long, the newsletter was bringing in over $100,000 a year. Counterattack did not originally intend to focus on media quite as much as it did, but it became significant for the Weavers and other entertainers because it was able to find a way to establish a remarkable amount of influence and control over the broadcast industry and advertising. This really began with a special report they called, quote, Red Channels, the Report of Communist Influence in Radio and Television, unquote. Published in June 1950, listing the names of 151 entertainers and commercial-slash-public personalities as quote-unquote known communists. Among the many names mentioned were actors Lee J. Cobb, Sam Wanamaker, Howard Da Silva, Woody Guthrie's friend Will Geer, Burgess Meredith, playwrights Arthur Milliter and Lillian Hellman, songwriters Earl Robinson and Mill Lampell, composers Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, and musicians Josh White, Burl Ives, and Pete Seeger. Where did American Business Consultants claim as their source of their information? Mostly FBI clippings of the Daily Worker. In regard to musicians, Counterattack not only labeled people as communists, but judgmentally stated that they were making improper career decisions about who they played for. The newsletter stated that there was proof for every quote-unquote citation they printed, that person A had attended a meeting of Organization B, or a quote-unquote front, which was subversive, and therefore this person was a communist. Really, much of what Counterattack had was just that something was printed in the Daily Worker. Whether it was actually true was beside the point. In a September 1947 issue, Counterattack stated directly what should be done with alleged communists. Quote, "Most important thing of all is to base your whole policy on a firmly moral foundation. Space should not be rented to the Communist Party or to any communist front. Supplies should not be sold to them. They should not be allowed to participate in meetings. Communist actors, announcers, directors, writers, producers, etc., whether in radio, theater, or movies, should all be barred to the extent permissible by law and union contracts." Unquote. They were even more direct in an October issue the following month, saying, quote, "The way to treat communists is to ostracize them." Unquote. But American business consultants did more than just list people, expecting show business companies to follow their lead in this ostracization. As broadcast historian Eric Barno explains in his book, The Golden Web, the company essentially operated as a corporate investigative firm that extorted other employers, companies, and organizations into purging their workers or affiliates that were suspected by Counterattack as being communists. How this operated was this. Counterattack would call an organization in show business, tell them one of their employees was questionable, and investigate them for a fee of $1,000. If the organization refused this service, then 3 weeks later, a story would end up being run in Counterattack, calling this person a quote-unquote fellow traveler, which was just as damaging. Because of this threat, NBC and CBS started requiring loyalty oaths of their employees. Television host Ed Sullivan, in fact, worked very closely with Counterattack, making sure no one mentioned in the newsletter came on his show. And if anyone was suspected, he made sure that they should be offered a loyalty oath. In regard to how this impacted the Weavers, Seeger was the only member listed in Red Channels. Even still, the group continued to remain on the charts. Goodnight Irene was still number one on the jukeboxes that September, and Xena was number four. In November, the quartet appeared on Milton Berle's show, Texaco Star Theater, and that same month, Irene was the best-selling record in the UK, all despite the labeling of Seeger in Counterattack. David Dunaway explains that the FBI and American business consultants were somewhat flabbergasted and annoyed that people were still flocking to hear the Weavers' music, even when they had been connected in print to communism. What it goes to show is that the listener was more concerned with the music than how the FBI or anti-communist reactionaries wanted to represent the musicians. However, while they made it through 1950 okay, by the time 1951 rolled around, the FBI and Counterattack began ramping up their efforts to cancel the Weavers. That summer, the group had been scheduled to perform on the Dave Garraway show when their contract was suddenly revoked. A month later, Garraway instead scheduled Connie Russell and the Songsmiths to perform their own version of Xena. Garraway claimed it at a later point he had forgotten about the whole incident and that he was just searching for the greatest talent. Neither this excuse for a performance of the same song by another group nor NBC's excuse that it was over scheduling issues is really convincing. That August, the group was set to perform at the Ohio State Fair, but ahead of the show, Ohio Governor Frank Lausch reached out to the FBI for any confidential information they could provide on the Weavers. It was completely illegal for any such elected officials to have this kind of documentation, as well as it was illegal for the Bureau to release anything like this, but J. Edgar Hoover decided to share it anyway. The Weavers were fired so quickly when information from their file became public that there wasn't time to remove their names from the programs. Governor Lausch had saved the Buckeyes from turning into calm simps from listening to On Top of Old Smoky and Rock Island Line. That same month, the Weavers were assailed by anti-communist journalist Frederick Waltman in the New York World Telegram. Waltman, who received the Pulitzer Prize in 1947 for distinguished reporting for his attacking people who had alleged connections to the Communist Party, also, according to David Dunaway, acquired FBI information from J. Edgar Hoover. Waltman criticized the integrity of the Weavers because of Seeger's former connections to the Almanac Singers and the Union Boys. Specifically, Waltman cited the anti-war song, The Ballad of October 16th, the chorus of which questioned the validity of entering in World War II before Pearl Harbor, a song that we have examined on this podcast before. Waltman also attempts to point out that the members of the Weavers had sung at many events connected to people involved with the Communist Party's activities in the 40s in an effort to further discredit the musicians.
Little Evelina sitting in the shade,
counting on the money that the Weavers ain't made.
Oh, well, the Rock Island Line, it is a mighty good road. Oh, well, the Rock Island Line, it is the road to ride. The Rock Island Line, it is a mighty good road. Well, if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find it. Get your ticket at the station for the Rock Island Line.
Alas, my love, you do me wrong to treat me so.
Because of all the bad publicity, Decca executive Pete Cameron held a press conference trying to defend the group, emphasizing that the Weavers had played for the DIR and the American Legion. Seeger spoke at this conference and later admitted he was shuffling around with his words, really not knowing what he could say that the press would defend him on. But the nail in the coffin for the Weavers' performing career came in February 1952, when a man named Harvey Mattuso gave testimony for the House Un-American Activities Committee. We will speak in much greater depth about the committee in the next episode, but for those listeners who are not familiar, HUAC was established originally in the late 1930s to investigate individuals and groups allegedly having ties to communism and or people who were involved in treasonous activities. As author Frank J. Donner emphasizes in his now out-of-print book, The Un-Americans, the committee's function never resulted in producing any real substantial laws that would be beneficial to the American public. It was in the late 1940s and early to mid-50s when the committee became more well-known with its predatory investigations and blacklisting of alleged communists. While HUAC and the FBI are, of course, separate institutions, there were certain levels of coordination between them. In their investigations of alleged communists, the FBI turned to paid informers, one of whom was Harvey Mattuso, a man who approached the Bureau on his own in 1950, claiming he had insider information on the Communist Party and wanted to offer up his services as an informant. As a matter of fact, Mattuso had been an informer for People's Songs and had gone under the name Harvey Matt, the fellow to whom we were introduced in the People's Songs episode, who left a bunch of bills and ordered records that went missing at the People's Songs office. Mattuso had found initial acceptance in the Communist Party, even winning a fully paid trip to Puerto Rico for selling record numbers of daily worker subscriptions, although many believe this was done fraudulently. Mattuso was later kicked out of the party for several possible reasons. For one, around 1950, the party began an internal initiative called the quote-unquote White Chauvinism Campaign, which sought to purge any members of bias towards blacks and people of color. If a member was accused of this, there was little defense that could be made, and such an attack would result in a sectarian removal from the organization. As Aaron J. Leonard explains, this evidently happened to Mattuso when he took a job as a debt collector in Harlem, collecting bills from blacks and Puerto Ricans. Mattuso later stated that his expulsion was also in part due to his efforts to sell advertisers for the black periodical Amsterdam News that contained advertisements for skin lighteners and hair straighteners. As Mattuso reflected on his own psychology in his memoirs, quote, "I took on a feeling of hurt and envy toward those who were criticizing me. This feeling of hurt grew stronger as I felt that these attacks were upon me. I felt alone again. I resented the attacks and the people who supported them. This resentment for a few grew to one against the Communist Party as a whole. I became bitter." Unquote. The party got suspicious of Mattuso's loyalties in general, though, and put out a piece of information in the Daily Worker with a photograph of Mattuso saying why he was expelled from the party. They stated that he, quote, "engaged in irregularities and misrepresentations during the press drive," unquote. The FBI had its own 7,000-page file on Mattuso, which includes text on alleged reasons for Mattuso's removal from the party, which included stealing funds from the Worker's bookshop and receiving the Daily Worker Award through improper means. When Matuso came to offer himself up as a stool pigeon, the Bureau internally recorded their interpretation of Matuso as being, quote, vain, egotistical, self-centered, and inclined to blow up his Communist Party background in order to make an impression, unquote. In many respects, we can conclude that Matuso was, for the most part, a naive and somewhat unaware opportunist, but nevertheless also a man who was being used and wasn't able to see how he was a victim in all this. Ultimately, in his loneliness, vulnerability, and desire for attention and notoriety, he was recruited by the FBI. In his February 6th and 7th testimony, Matuso stated that he knew for certain that three of the Weavers were members of the Communist Party. Lee Hayes, Matuso claimed, had quit. In a single testimony, Matuso also named a variety of other folk musicians as possible communists, notably blues player Sonny Terry, folk musician Tom Glazier, and Canadian-born Oscar Brand, although Matuso claimed he couldn't be sure about these others officially. Matuso had actually rehearsed his testimony in the offices of Counterattack and with Roy Cohn, Joseph McCarthy's aide, before actually giving his testimony, thus providing a statement with full support of HUAC even before it happened. When the story of Matuso's testimony broke in the news, so few people and People's Artists remembered who this guy was that Irwin Silber sent somebody to find a picture of him, except that that person also turned out to be an informer and reported in to the Bureau. When all this hit the media, it was wildfire. The Weavers were playing in Ohio and walked into a hotel lobby to find people reading a newspaper with the headlines, Weavers Named Reds. That afternoon, the Associated Press phoned the Yankee Inn in Ohio where the quartet was playing. Frightened by the publicity and all the questions, the venue manager canceled the Weavers' contract immediately. The group went down the ladder of venues soon after this, eventually performing at joints like dinner clubs in Kansas City, the Rotary Club in Pasadena, and Daffy's Bar and Grill on the city limits of Cleveland. The American Legion attempted to get Daffy to cancel the show at his place, but here was one man who held fast for the quartet. Daffy's response to the Legion asking to fire the group was, quote, hell no, it's just music. Quit hassling me, or I'll get my boys on you, unquote. It is pretty remarkable looking back what one testimony did to the Weavers. If you're wondering about the outcome of Harvey Matuso, he was later indicted for perjury for admitting that he had made false statements about the Weavers and for statements he made during his July 1952 testimony for the committee against Alexander Trachtenberg, the head of International Publishers, which published radical and leftist literature, much of which was on behalf of the Communist Party. Matuso was sentenced to 5 years at Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, of which he served a little over 3.5 years. For those interested in his story, it is encapsulated in his memoir, False Witness, published in 1955.
Well, now some folks say a man is made out of mud, but a poor man's made out of muscle and blood, skin and bone, a mind that's weak and a back that's strong.
You load 16 ton, and what do you get? You get another day older and a deeper in debt. Don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
The Weavers struggled through the rest of 1952, and by 53 they had lost the battle in getting gigs. Decca informed the Weavers that record stores were now refusing to stock their records. While this was all severely impacting their livelihoods, Seeger got particularly annoyed when Pete Cameron told all four members of the group that they absolutely could not play If I Had a Hammer. Seeger's response was that they could have written, I don't have a hammer, a bell, or a song, but I have you, honey, but they didn't choose to sing a cop-out like that. In short, Pete would not relinquish his principles for anything. And, while Decca might have stuck up for their act in the beginning a little, they were now kowtowing to the blacklist. In time, as we know, in about 10 years, the Weavers' songs would come back to television, radio, and record stores, and would have a tremendous impact. But being unable to tour now as a group, the Weavers were effectively disbanded. Seeger turned to alternative ways to make a living. One of his first shows since the fallout with Decca and Matuso's HUAC testimony was a People's Artist concert at New York City's Webster Hall in the spring of 1954, where Seeger was very warmly welcomed by the 1,000 attendees. Seeger also started his own column in Sing Out magazine, although this did not bring in any money. To get gigs, Pete and Toshi sent letters to colleges, universities, schools, summer camps, and churches in the Northeast, as well as around the country. They'd also proactively call up local television and radio stations, saying Seeger would be performing at the local high school that night, and could he also come on one of their shows to play live. Many would remember him as having been with the Weavers, and he was often invited in for such things. The Communist Party also had a network at this time, and played an important role in finding work for Seeger. As Don McLean explains, quote, Pete went underground. He started doing $50 bookings, then $25 dates, at schoolhouses, auditoriums, and eventually college campuses. He definitely pioneered what we know today as the college circuit. He persevered and he went out like Kilroy, sowing seeds at a grassroots level for many, many years. The blacklist was the best thing that ever happened to him. It forced him into a situation of struggle, which he thrived on. Unquote. Now, to be appropriately critical, this wasn't necessarily as ideal a situation as McLean maybe makes it out to be. But Pete's efforts during this time did develop an audience that would fall in love with him and his music, creating followers where none existed before. Later in life, Pete would reflect on the mid to late 50s, saying it was a very important time for him, because he was able to play for people he wanted to play for, play the songs he wanted to play, and make the connections he wanted to make. In a sense, despite the censorship of the blacklist, he had found a certain category of freedom for himself and for his music. Now, while there was a sense of creative and socio-political freedom for him during this period, Seeger would have to drive long distances to make a very small income, and as such continued to be away from his family, but overall was able to spend more time at home than before. Finally, during the summer of 1955, Pete took a break from his regional touring for pennies and was joined by friends who were coming up from the city to help build a new office and barn. One afternoon in August, the work crew that was there helping were about to raise the barn walls when a shiny car emerged at the top of Seeger's long driveway. A man in a suit got out and approached Pete. "Are you Pete Seeger?" Pete replied in the affirmative, and the man said, "I've got something for you." Pete was handed an envelope, and the man made an about-face and drove away. Pete took a closer look at the envelope. The seal of the House of Representatives was on it. It was a subpoena to appear in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee in 2 weeks' time.
Last Saturday night I got married. Me and my wife settled down. Now me and my wife are partying. I'm gonna take another stroll downtown.
Well,
thanks for listening to our episode on the Weavers. I'm so glad this episode is done. It was fun and it was interesting, and I certainly discovered that there was a lot I didn't know, but it was a chore, this episode. A lot went into the research for this one. What I learned, which I wasn't totally appreciative of, was just how the Weavers were impacted by the different particular institutional powers against them, and understanding exactly the role that counterattack had, and the exact role the FBI had, in the web, the network, the entanglement of these institutions to try and shut down the Weavers, and what it took for them to try and be able to do so. And I was only minorly aware of Harvey Matusow's story. I didn't, know the complexities behind all of it, and how complicated his desire to brat on the Weavers was, but so much of what happened seems to hinge on this one guy. It's hard to say, but like without Matusow, we ask ourselves, would the Weavers' commercial career have been cut short by those institutions that canceled them. Would that have happened in the same way? It's hard to tell. That's hindsight. We can't really know. But it's natural, I think, to wonder what might have happened without HUAC. As we can see, the group remained popular even with Red Channels and Counterattack going after them. It had to be something more direct to get show business to try and shut down the group. Obviously it wasn't happening by itself. The listeners weren't the people that cared. It was economic institutions that cared more. As we'll learn, Pete would of course go on to see that the Weavers were successful in numerous ways at combining the old and the new. Even if certain songwriters of the early 60s weren't interested in them on all levels, Pete did inspire others during the 50s that led to a certain artistic and political renaissance in the 60s. Joan Baez saw Seger during this time. Roger McGuinn saw Seger during this time. Happy Trom saw Seger during this time. And it's interesting and impressive how all this happened. So in the next episode, we turn to Pete having to face the committee in 1955 and how exactly this impacted him personally as we discuss the blacklist more explicitly, not just with Pete, but how other folk musicians chose to face the committee as well. So please follow on Facebook and Instagram at Pete Seeger Podcast, and if you like, patreon.com/PeteSeegerPodcast. Your contributions would help the show be produced on a level that folk music really deserves. So thank you for considering that. There is a Season, the Pete Seeger Podcast, is produced, written, and distributed by Adam C. Morris. See you all next time. Thank you.